If we assume that the purpose of this world system is efficiency, why is it that as you said, it sounds strange to common people? You know, how is it that it is hard not to access it, but to become aware of it? You know, so let's take a guy that is not isolated in the nature, you know, and how could it come to that understanding, you know, without studying like you did, and if he can't come to that understanding, what's the purpose of those dimensions if they are so hard to reach, you know, like become aware of them?
Okay.
One last thing, what is near this experience is related, how are they related to this, and are they sort of system leaking or you know, a bigger picture that comes to mind, but why at that time?
Okay. I'll try to remember all those. First is what did they do? So you just take a naive person and says, well, I'd like to experience the larger consciousness system. How do I go do that? I'm not going to get in the lab and work with people for you know, a decade like Dennis and I did. So what they can do to get started, I'd actually send them to the my workshops that I get up on YouTube, because at the end of the workshop, what I usually do is on a Friday, I give just an overview of what's going on. Saturday, I do theory. Why does it work? How does it work? What's the point and purpose? Then Sunday, we do applications, and I teach people there. I give them the instruction how to experience the larger consciousness system and things to do, things to not do, and so on. So I'd start there because that's where you'd get some instruction, and you'd get some things to try to do. So that would be a good place to start. And what really I have them doing is healing with their minds and remote viewing, because those are easy to do. And I'd say 30-40% of the people get successes on their healing, diagnosing, and remote viewing right there without any preparation, without studying, without ever trying, you know, just the first time they ever tried it. We get probably around 40% have success immediately. That's how easy it is. It's just not that hard. Now, once they have some success, they end up then having less success because now they've got some emotion. They've got some, there's some fear like, well, gee, I got it. What if I, you know, can I do this again? And now they have their intellects in it. And as soon as their intellect gets in it, it doesn't work for them very well. Whereas the first time they were just open. Oh, this is a little crazy. I'm just going to try it and see what happens. That's the right attitude. The attitude of, oh, that really worked. Now I need to get serious and do this, you know, and now they have their ego and their intellect in it, because now they're trying to do it, and the trying gets in the way of actually doing it. So it's one of these things that it's not a technique that you have to know that enables you to do it. It's stopping doing all the things that you're doing that inhibits it. So it's not a matter of doing something. It's mostly a matter of not doing all the things that get in the way. So that's go there, and you'll find a pathway that if you work on it for some time, will probably render you enough experience in the larger reality that you can claim that in your mind it's probably real. Now I say it's probably real because this, again, reality is about probability. You should be open-minded, and you just approach this with an open mind and no expectations, and you need to be skeptical. You should always be skeptical. If it doesn't, you know, if let's say you do these things and it doesn't work out for you, or even if it does work out for you and you do heal and you do remote view accurately, you should still be skeptical. What if that was good luck? What if that, whatever? Just stay skeptical. And the more you put time into it, that percentage of your skepticism, let's say, I think it's probably true 20% and probably my imagination 80%. Fine, that's a good place to start. 5 years later, it'll probably be the other way around. It's probably 80% that it is as I experience it, and 20% that I'm doing a hallucination. and so on. As you go further, that the amount of skepticism about the reality of what you're doing will just get smaller and smaller, but it should never go to zero. You should always have some skepticism about what you're doing. Otherwise, you will likely wander down some path that your ego wants to take rather than doing what's real. So that was part of the first question. How do you do it? Remote viewing and healing are the easy things to do that most everybody can do if they work at it. And you can go to any number of classes for out-of-body, any number of classes for remote viewing, and go on the web and Google those things, because there's hundreds of people that would like to teach you how to do those things, and they will work with you if you want to do that. But you can do it just on your own. The second one is what purpose? You know, why do this? There is no requirement whatsoever to do this or any paranormal thing. It's not really very important to what's most important. And what's most important is the purpose of why you're here. What are you doing here? Who are you? And, you know, and what are you supposed to be trying to achieve? And that is, you're supposed to be growing up, lowering your entropy, increasing the quality of your consciousness. That's the role. And you can do that without ever going out of body or remote viewing anything or any of the other paranormal things are not required. The only reason for doing these sorts of things would be if you are a left brain person who has to have the experience, prove it to yourself. Okay. I just can't believe, or I can't connect with this as being real unless I experience it as being real. So if you're one of those who has to experience it in order to work with it, it's like, okay, I have to spend 5 years learning how to play the piano or meditate, but I don't want to do that if I find out 5 years later that all I've been doing is talking to myself, you see. So in order to make this investment, I need to have some sense that I'm doing something that's real. Well, it may take you 5 years just to convince yourself you're doing something that's real. But in any case, you need to do that. And if you're one of those persons, you won't start. You can't seriously work. You can't give it the attention it needs unless you first prove it to yourself. For those people, that's really the only value of this going out of body and remote viewing or doing other, looking at future probability. And there's lots of things you can do, you know, past lives, empathy with people, seeing the world, seeing their reality through their eyes, and all kinds of things you can do there. But there's no point in it other than the fact that it can help you grow up. It doesn't have to help, you know, you can grow up without it, but it can help you grow up because it helps you get excited, have the interest, put the work into it that you need to put into it. So that's the why bother. Now, for me, I had a different purpose. I'm a physicist. I was trying to model reality, and I needed to do research there. You may or may not have that drive. You know, if you're a science guy at heart and that's what you need to do, then, you know, you can do that too. But most people really aren't all that interested in doing science. They just want to have the experience so they know whether it's real or not. That's the thing. And that's a, you know, if you're one of those, then you need to go do that. You have to do that first. I was one of those. I had to do that first. Some people don't. Mostly the right brain people, the people who are very intuitive, they don't need logical process. They just skip right over logical process and go right to the answer. They just can't explain it. And everybody calls them airheads and that sort of thing. But they often know things that nobody else does. So that's another path. And that's perfectly fine to them. They don't like logical process. That's slow and tedious and gets in the way. They can go past that very quickly. So that's kind of the, you know, what's the purpose? Why should you do it? Well, only if you want to. If it's not important to you, then it's not important. Just let it go. You can grow up without it. And what was your last one? You had a third one you slipped in there at the end.
Yeah, sure. I was wondering why those experiences can happen sometimes triggered by something else, like in a sleep state or when you die, if you think that near-death experiences are related to this. Why does this happen, you know, like that, without the possibility for the experiencer to understand what's happening?
Okay. What that happens lots of times, and that's why this number of people who have had some kind of paranormal experience, that's why that number is up at 80%. Most of those people, of that 80% that says that, there probably isn't 0.01% that had any control over it, nor would they experience something that was happens all the time. It was just this, like, this one event, this thing that happened, or maybe it happened 2 or 3 times. But typically, what this is about is that it's an eye opener, it's a mind opener, it's an event that is given to you if you are ready to see that there is a bigger picture than just the physical. Now, why is that important? Well, our mission here is to grow up, to become love, to increase the quality of our consciousness. And if you are entirely focused on the physical, that's a much slower process. That's like learning how to swim with a cement block tied to your back. You know, it's just hard to do. So to see that reality, that world, that your life, that you are a multidimensional being, and understanding this is a big aid into your growing up. If not, there's nothing important that isn't physical. If it isn't physical, it doesn't exist. You see, that's very limiting for your understanding. So the system whose success, the system needs to lower its entropy. This consciousness system is a digital information system. It needs to limit its entropy, and we individuated units of consciousness are part of its scheme to do that. As we lower our entropy, we're part of it. It lowers its entropy. So you see, we're part of this evolutionary process of the consciousness system. That's what we do. So that's that's why that happens. The system wants us to succeed, wants us to improve the quality of our consciousness, wants us to grow up. And to help us do that, it gives us these little experiences of the larger reality, which is what opens our minds. And even if we say, yeah, it's all physical, but you know, I had this dream once, and it was really, really complex, and 2 weeks later, it happened exactly. All right? Now, that person has their mind open. Even if they are a scientist and claim to be a materialist, they know at a deeper level that there are things that happen and go on that cannot be answered by a materialist viewpoint, from a materialist viewpoint.
Tom,
so that just opens them to a bigger picture.
Is there a potential flip side to that where, you know, we talk with the people who are very left-brained and might need to be sort of awakened to this other possibility? But do you see a need for people who might be, let's say, too right-brained or something, maybe a need for an embodiment and things like that?
Yeah, it works both ways. The system helps us move in a direction that we are ready to move and need to move for our growth. So if there's a person who is very left-brained and everything is physical, if they can deal with it, you know, if it's not going to just frighten them and push them into denial, which is not helpful at all, but if they're ready to deal with it, then they're good candidates for getting that kind of an experience. And on the other hand, if they're right-brained and they get it all, but they don't have the logical process, they often, you know, get nudged toward, you know, a more logical process, understanding it, trying to figure it out. So it works both ways, because both of those are out of balance. If you're all right brain, you're out of balance. If you're all left brain, and when I say all, I mean that's how you run your life. You run your life out of your head. That's a left brain thing. If you're right brain, you run your life out of your intuition. And neither one of those is really, the best way to be. You need to be both. You need to have both well developed, so you are all left brain and all right brain both together all of the time. That means you are very intuitive. You're in touch. You're connected to a larger reality, but at the same time, logical process is the way you operate and run your life. So that's the system pushes people however it is they need to be pushed, but the very large majority of people don't see the bigger picture until they have something personal, some big picture thing happen to them, and then they get it. Mostly they don't talk about it because they feel like people will think they've imagined it or that they're crazy or something, but they got it just the same. Near-death experiences are like that as well. That's somebody who actually clinically dies but is resuscitated. And while they're clinically gone, they'll often have some sort of an experience. Well, that experience is just there for a couple of reasons. One, it may be something given to them, or once they clinically die, they may begin the transition and get some of the transition experience before it looks like they get resuscitated and then it comes back. It depends on that probability. If the probability is high that they will get resuscitated, then it's generally something that has to be given to them. If the probability is low that they get resuscitated, then they may just be starting out on part of their transition, but the odd thing happens and they get pulled back. So all of these things are things that are important, and they do add up. You know, if you get if one of these things happens, some paranormal things happen to you, it's not the paranormal thing. It's not the information you get that's important, or the dream that you saw. This precognitive dream may have been mundane. I saw somebody, they went to the gas station and they dropped their, wedding ring off their finger into the back seat, and then it's just mundane stuff. Later it comes true, but what happened is not important. It's the fact that it did happen, that you had the experience. It's the experience that's important, not the content of that experience. So people wonder about, well, gee, what did all that mean? Why did I get that? Well, what you got was not as insignificant. It's that you got it at all is what's significant. Yeah, so does that answer your question?
Yeah, I saw an article recently, kind of what you're saying there. I forget who it was. It was a famous atheist movement figure had some sort of experience where an old radio started playing. He tells his whole story about it was tied into his wedding night and all these sorts of things. And he kept using this expression, my atheism was shaken to its core, or something like that, or skepticism. And which obviously, in one respect, the cynic in me, that sort of proves that atheism in itself is a dogma. It is a belief system, because that's the phraseology we would use for, my faith was shaken.
Sure.
So in one respect, I get a kick out of it that way. On the other hand, it's absolutely, these little moments that all these, I know so many people who are so tied down to that mindset. And when something happens that you can't explain, it'll certainly throw a question mark on that pretty darn quickly. What about, again, let's, sort of flip this script one more time and say, so we have the people who are in this one mindset and this could wake them up to the other possibility. What about the things that make us question our faith, belief, hopefulness, etc.? You were talking about the idea of World of Warcraft. It sort of seems like that is the world we're living in. It is a pretty brutal reality most days. How do you respond to the system, the idea that the system is either a quote-unquote negative one, right? We have this is a very old Gnostic idea that yes, the world is a virtual reality, but it's sort of like a prison, right? So you have that Philip K. Dick black iron prison, or this this Gnostic idea that it's basically something for us to be trapped in. Or you have this sort of more new agey pronoia idea that it is there and it is a system that is actually serving us in some way. How would you respond to these sorts of questions?
Well, what you see is what we are. So we are in a a virtual reality, but we are consciousness, and we are to experience here. That's our thing. We come here and we have experience. Now, what makes experience is our choices. We have free will. And depending on how we make these choices, we tend to evolve toward lower entropy or higher entropy, toward love or toward fear. Now, you can't have free will in the system and say, you have the free will to choose what I want you to choose. That's not free will. You have to have the free will to make the wrong choice if you have the free will to make the right choice. You can't have half a free will. You're free as long as you do what I want you to do. So we have this bunch of consciousnesses interacting with each other. They have lots of fear, lots of ego, lots of beliefs, and they interact. Some of them are evolving. Some of them are de-evolving. Some of them are just, you know, wandering around clueless in the playing field. They're not really doing much of anything. They're wasting a lot of time. So they interact together. All of this fear and all of this ego interacts with each other. Choices are made. Intents form. So they have intents. And these intents modify future probability. That's part of the feedback system. So you're in. Intent modifies future probability. This is a probabilistic simulation. It's not a deterministic simulation. Deterministic simulations don't make any sense. They are not efficient, not productive, and unnecessary. Why would you do something that's terribly inefficient when it's unnecessary? So in any case, that's the situation. So why do we live in such a tough world with so much negativity, you know, so much greed, so much, you know, fear, because that's who we are. That's the world we create. That's a reflection of us, of we the people. That's our average or our common level of growth is what we see. We create it. And we have this idea that if we just, you know, change the government, change the money system, change the, you know, things in a way that would make everything better. It wouldn't make anything better for very long. Well, it may make things marginally better for a while. But the fact is, the world we live in is going to have to represent us because we make it. We create it. We do it. It's our choice, our intents that make it the way it is. It's the sum of all the choices being made by all the people on it is why it is the way it is. And those won't change. So as long as the people don't grow up any and you have the same quality of consciousness, you're going to get basically the same result. You see, that's just a fact. So it's us that makes it like that. And we have lots of choices. We can grow up and it would be a lot better. It'd be a kinder, gentler, more satisfying, less frustrating place to be. Or we can de-evolve and it can be a meaner, tougher place than what we have, but it's us. It's not that this world is different. You know, we see ourselves as separate from it. That's these other views you're talking about. We're separate. This world is just here, and it is the way it is. And we, for some unfortunate reason, get placed in this hellhole. You know, because we've been naughty children, and this is our punishment, or because, you know, whatever. That's they come up with their own reasons of why it's. Like that, but basically they see themselves as being placed in a situation. Well, that's not the way it is. They are part of the situation. We all create this situation and we can change it, but we change it by growing up, and that's the way it is. Now, you could have any kind of government, doesn't matter what it is, if all the people in that system, say you have a system. If you want, make it a country and put walls up around that country so it just is a system all by itself. Whatever that system is, if it's, and start with a government that's any sort of government, can be a totalitarian, mean dictatorship if you like. Start it anyway. If the people grow up and become love, the system will change to support that. You see? The system, whatever. Or there's the money, the economic system, whatever, it'll change to support that because it will be a reflection of that caring and love. It'll be about other. It won't be about greed. Greed's about self. Fear's about self. It'll be about other. So if the people grow up, the system will grow up. The leaders we pick represent us. They're picked out of the same pool of population. They're just like us. So you take a, you know, and another way to say that is if you went out and randomly selected somebody and made him the, you know, the leader for life, chances are not much would change, because basically that's the way we are. There's a lot of ego, a lot of fear, a lot of belief. It's what about me? Greed. I want to control, you see? And you take the little guy who has very little power, well, all he can do is argue with his wife, kick the dog, and, you know, and keep doing what people tell him. Whereas the guy who has lots of power, you know, can make huge messes and affect a lot of people with his ego and his fear. The little guy can only affect his wife, kids, and the dog with his ego and his fear, because everybody else is his boss. So that's the difference. But one isn't a whole lot different than the other. We're not in the problems we're in because of our terrible leaders. We're in the problems we're in because we are like that ourselves. And I say we, I'm taking plural, we humanity, we the people, not we every individual. Obviously, there's lots of individuals who are very loving, wonderful people, but there's not enough of them.
Yeah, and if I may, just to argue from like a physiological point of view, the prefrontal cortex of human beings is still a relatively new thing. We're still grasping with like a new technology, our own inner technology. So we're always projecting out into the world and building new toys and calling that technology, and how do we master that thing outside of ourselves instead of mastering what's right inside our own heads. And so human beings are trying to reconcile three brains in one. I was just talking with Guillaume about this before we came on the air. And that's extremely complex. So we have our mammalian brain, our reptilian brain, and our prefrontal cortex. How do we make all that work? And there is, of course, what you're talking about, this extra physical reality interplaying with consciousness and interacting with physical reality. And so they're kind of two sides of the same coin. But I mean, if we're just, if people want to keep their feet down on physical ground, if you want to argue it from this point of view, you have this triune brain or this three-way brain, and we're still adolescents dealing with that in the same way of what you're saying in a larger symbolic sense and also from a very grounded sense as well. But, you know, we're still dealing with, we're not mature. Human beings have been around for a long time, so we assume we have it figured out, but we don't have shit figured out.
Okay.
Well, that's part of it.
Yeah, the way to see this from a different viewpoint. So the viewpoint you talk about is that we have a brain, and the brain modifies or has some impact on our behavior. So we got this, you know, reptilian brain, and that does with the fear, fight or flight, and that sort of thing. We have the kind of that basic. We have all these different brain type inputs. And we, poor little unfortunate people, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of this brain that has all these functions, and we're trying to, kind of quiet some of them and do more with others. But it's just the brain doesn't run consciousness, you see. It's a virtual brain. Your brain is just data. Matter of fact, unless somebody cuts open your head, the system never has any cause to even render a brain. It's just that you probably have a brain, so you act certain ways. You see, the brain is a physical thing. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't push anything. The body sets the constraints on what the consciousness does. Now, a little story to kind of explain this. Sometime back on the internet, I read about an article that was saying it was an amazing thing. Biologists thought that sheep seemed to have morality. There was moral behavior among sheep. And what they had witnessed was that mother sheep would take care of baby sheep if that baby's mother was killed or gone or not there to take care of it. The other mama sheep would come in and let that outsider lamb suckle. And they looked at that and they said, well, that's counter to what we know about biology. Animals are supposed to only do things for their own benefit to further their own genetic material, and they don't give sustenance to outsiders at the expense of their own genetic material. In other words, this mother sheep had her own lambs to suckle, and her sustenance, her milk, could only be spread so far, but she was sharing it. She was taking that away from her own to help another. And they said, that is moral behavior. It's moral choice. So the thing we scientists tend to do when we find something like that is, you know, we kill the lamb, right? That's and we chop open the skull and we look at the brain and, aha, look, there's the lobe in which where moral choice is done. Because humans who have moral choice, they have this lobe and they've centered, you know, put people in a brain scan, give them moral questions, and they see that that's the part of the brain that kind of lights up when they're doing moral choice. So then they have the idea that their brain evolved this lobe which allowed them to be moral, and that's what we're seeing as the result of this brain development. We're seeing that morality. That is just backwards. You see, the sheep are conscious. They're a consciousness. They're doing the same thing we're doing. They're trying to evolve the quality of their consciousness too. The sheep became moral by choice, by free will choice. As they did, the brain had to modify to support that. It's just a virtual brain. But the physical body, including the brain, sets the constraints, you see? So here I am, a consciousness, and my avatar can't jump but so far because the rule set has constraints. My my avatar can't, learn 5 languages in a weekend because it has constraints. The rule set that enabled it to evolve to what it is has these constraints. And we, consciousness, get a data stream that is constrained according to the rule set.
Hello, are you squeezing, guys?
Brain function that is pushing us and pulling us all around, it's the other way around. We have fear, we have ego, we have all these beliefs, we've got these fear of, you know, we've fright and flight, and what is it, fight or flight. We've got all this stuff, and our brain represents us, and it's there not pushing us around, but it's there to support who we are, you see?
Yes.
So you just look at it from the other side. That's 180 degrees out of phase from the normal way of looking at it. So we have this reptilian brain and these other kinds of brains, and they are what they are because they have to be there to allow us as consciousness to express ourselves, because that's the way we are. You see, now let's say we stop expressing ourselves in terms of fear and greed and all these other kinds of things. Well, then those parts of our brain begin to shrink. Because now we only express those things every once in a long while. So that part of the brain just goes away. And if we spend all our time in love and caring about other, well, the part of the brain that does that and the moral part of the brain and whatever, that grows, you see. So we're not driven by our brain. We drive the brain. Consciousness is fundamental and primary. And this virtual reality is a derived thing, is a computed thing. So consciousness doesn't come from the brain. People don't get out of their body because their consciousness lives in their brain and their body, and then somehow it flies out. You know, all of that is just wrong. And it's the way we think, because we are habituated to a physical set of constraints in this reality frame. So we tend to think in terms of those constraints. We think physical comes first and everything else is derived from it. That's why we have those ideas. But you see, the backwards, if you see it the other way, it makes more sense. And it's actually the way it works. So
yeah.
First we have to grow up and then our brain will change.
Yes. And I agree. And I didn't mean to give the impression I was opposed to what you're saying. I'm just, I was being a little bit of devil's advocate, but not being devil's advocate. I'm just saying there's other ways of seeing it, but you're absolutely right in that we know for sure that we don't always need a brain for consciousness. That's pretty clear. It's like, I love the analogy. Bruce Grayson, one of the leading researchers in this field, he said that.
Same here. Could you reach yourself? You said there was some
consciousness.
There's somebody who said,
I'm sorry,
and that's the last I heard.
I just lost audio. I didn't hear about the last 30 seconds.
I hear you just fine, yes.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah, you've been breaking up all along, but usually the dropouts have only been like a half a second dropout, so it didn't make a difference. We could just kind of
piece it together.
Plug in, yeah, as we went, but that one was a long one.
Diffraction.
Okay. All right. Well, interrupt me again if for some reason it happens, but I was just saying that we need to extend a model of consciousness. We need a relativity for consciousness to compensate for these altered states, whether you're near death or you're in a yogic state or something. And so your model and the ideas that you're putting forth are kind of going in that direction. And it's clear that, again, like you have hydrocephalus, where people have, I don't know, 5 to 10% of a normal brain, and they still are perfectly functioning human beings. Not all the time, but a strange chunk of the time. And then near-death experience, people see things, hear things they should never see, hear, or experience. And those have convinced me. And so your work adds to that pile, and I see it as very important in that sense. So I'll stop there because I don't want my mic to get messed up again. So go on.
Okay. Well, the difference is that a lot of people are aware that these things happen, right? That the NDEs and the other things you mentioned. A lot of people are aware of that, and many will point to those things and say, "See, you know, reality is really bigger than just the physical," and so on. But what's really been missing up to this time, and things like that we've known for a long time. It goes back, thousands of years. You know, you can read Taoism, the Tao Te Ching, and you can see that all these same kind of concepts, knowing this about the reality, has been around a long, long time. What's been missing is a coherent explanation, a coherent model that not only describes the metaphysics and the spiritual and the subjective part of the world, but that same model has to also explain physics and explain, why physics is the way it is and solve physics problems with it. So if we have this one understanding that does both of those and does all of that, then that's a model that, now I'm not saying that's reality. Again, don't ever confuse the model of reality with reality. But at least that allows us to talk about all these things as one set of ideas, and we can explain all of the stuff, be it the relativity and quantum mechanics, or be it a near-death experience, or how telepathy is possible, and why precognitive dreams are the way they are, and how is it that people, what was it called a long time, the power of positive thinking. How is it that people can modify their reality with their intent? The placebo effect. How is it they can modify their health with their intent? And then all of these things that are in our experience base become completely understandable within one context that also does quantum mechanics and also does physics. So that's kind of the overview of what we really have been trying to work toward for a long time. And I've got part of that, and other people, of course, have been adding to that and describing things, and it all works together, and it's, my own models and things, they'll be added to over the years and whatever and changed and rearranged to better suit. But I see that all the people you talk about and all the people that are working on us, we're all working toward the same goal, and it's all... So I say it's all additive. All the work that everybody has done in these areas, whether it's in physics or metaphysics or theology or spirituality, all of it adds together and makes for a better, more comprehensive, bigger picture. So it's all good, and it's all necessary, and it all adds.
Tom, could you extrapolate on the notion of entropy and how can one look? Where is entropy?
Okay, yes. The idea of entropy, I'll just kind of skip back to the statement that the larger consciousness system is a digital information system. And information requires, let's put it this way. What is information? It's structure. Okay, if you have all randomness, if all your bits are random, there is no information. In order to have information, some of those bits need to be structured into some sort of order, right? Now, we think maybe structured into letters of the alphabet or sounds of speech or something. Well, that's structure. That's not randomness. Random sound will never be speech. You see, there's no information in it. It has to have its certain sounds and inflections and that sort of thing before it becomes language. So order is what creates information out of randomness. Well, entropy is a measure of disorder. If entropy is high, that means there's a lot of disorder, a lot of randomness, very little information. If entropy is low, then you have more information, more content, more significance of that content. So now, if you have a digital information system, if it evolves, it's evolving toward lower entropy states, more information, more significance to its content, more structure, more meaning, you see. And if you have a digital information system that is de-evolving, it's becoming more and more random, less content, less value. And if that continues to de-evolve, you'll have nothing but randomness, and then you have no consciousness at all. There's no information. So randomness is death to an information system. That's how it dies. It becomes random. And growth and becoming more and growing up is lowering entropy. More information, more content, more value to the information, more significance and meaning. So that's, you know, that's the way the whole system works. So what we're here, we are pieces of this logical, we are pieces of this larger consciousness system, and our job is to grow up, to lower our entropy, add some sort of content, some sort of value to the whole, and we do that by becoming love. Now, why is it that what does becoming love have to do with all this? Well, a consciousness system is not just a one thing. It's a large number of individuated consciousness. It's a lot of individual things interacting. It's a social system. Whenever you have interaction, you have a social system. And this larger conscious system has broken off and made a lot of individuated units of consciousness, just like biological things did, right? Biological things were just all single-celled, and then they could divide and made multi-cell, and these things divide, which made other things, and they interact with each other. The interaction raises the novelty, the choices. The number of choices you have goes up if you have more things interacting. See, there's more choices than if it's just one thing or two things. Multiple things create choices. Choices that are made well enable you to evolve or de-evolve to, you know, you can now construct things that are complex, that are low entropy, if you have lots of things to construct with. If it's just one or two things, your construction is kind of limited. So we find out that consciousness then has evolved to a multi-celled thing with lots of cells of consciousness, and these interact with each other with free will, and that's what drives the system. That's how the system evolves. So now here we are. I did all this background to say here we are, and our job is to lower our entropy because we're parts of this system, and it's a social system, and a social system improves, does better, lowers its entropy if it's cooperative, if the units inside the social system cooperate with each other, help each other, if it's about each other and not just about themselves. That's called love. If it's just about them, if it's all about me, how do I get what I need and want, and then how do I keep it? Somebody else has something that I want, then how do I take it away from them and keep it? If it's all about self, then that's fear. And there's no trust. There can't be trust. With no trust, you know, there's no cooperation, and so on. And you have the opposite. You have a system that de-evolves. Fear is very divisive. Things don't build and construct. As soon as somebody constructs something worth taking, then others conspire to take it. And that's the fear side. Okay, so you have the fear side and the love side. Becoming love means lowering your entropy and evolving the quality of your consciousness. The fear side, you know, represents higher entropy and de-evolving the quality of your consciousness. So now we've gone through all that background. I'm getting up finally to your question. The point is, we're here to lower our entropy, to evolve the quality of our consciousness, or you can call that spiritual growth if you like. And that's our purpose. That's what we do. Now, how does one go about doing that? Well, the way to do that is find the fear and get rid of it. Now, how do you find the fear? Most of us are driven by our fear and our ego and our beliefs, and we have no idea what that fear and ego and beliefs are. To us, they're just life. It's the way it is. Couldn't be any different. But you can find that fear by looking at the ego. The ego is easy to find. You can find the ego anytime your life is not full of joy, anytime you're not happy and pleased and life is wonderful. If that's not your life, you can find fear. You can find ego. Anytime you feel anxiety, upset, angry, frustrated, any of these things that most of us feel, you know, all the time, you know, if not every day, every week, all of those things, you feel that way because of your fear. And you express that fear in terms of ego and beliefs. So when you feel that way, let's say you're feeling anger. So if you feel anger or frustration, find out why. Where is that coming from? Why am I angry? Well, I'm angry because you're not doing what you're supposed to do. You see, well, why is it that I need you to have to do these things? Well, if you don't do those things, it's not good for me. I don't get what I want. I don't get what I need. You need to do those things for me. Well, it's all about me, you see. So keep tracing that back until you find your fear. What is it that you fear that makes you need to have those things? You see, so if you do this and you're honest with yourself, you will find the fear, ego, and beliefs that drive you. And when you do, you just have to get rid of them. The only antidote for fear is courage. So you have to look at that fear and understand it and be with it and own it. And once you've admitted to it and own it, then you can just be watchful for it. And when that anger pops up in your life, go, oh, I know where that's coming from. Let it go. Stop the anger right in its tracks. Instead, do something positive. Instead of getting angry with someone, take a deep breath and realize that they are in the same position as you. Everybody's doing the best they can with what they got to grow up. And we all are driven by our fear and ego, and you don't need to react with your fear and ego to somebody else's fear and ego, because that's just pouring gasoline on the fire. It just makes everything worse. So take a deep breath, say something nice and positive, and let it go. That'll be hard to do. You will catch yourself and not catch it in time in the beginning most of the time. But if you work at it consistently, within a few months, 3 or 4 months, you'll be very successful. And if you keep working at it, it'll go away. The fear will just disappear because these fears are all paper tigers. All the awful things you think might happen if, you know, it doesn't work this way and you don't get what you need and this person doesn't do what they're supposed to, there's no awful things there. It's just your fear. And once you have the courage to let that fear go and work at it, it'll just disappear, and that'll be one less thing that pushes you around now in your life and makes you feel unhappy, upset, and angry and frustrated and all the rest of it. Keep doing that, and pretty soon you're a real happy camper. Your life is full of joy. Everything is really good, and other people just are the way they are, and you stop trying to control everything and make it be the way you know is best. You say that, I know what's best. I know the way these things have to be. That's just your ego talking. And then the other people don't do it that way. Now you're frustrated and you're angry. And that's your ego. That's your fear. So that's how you beat it. You find it, trace it back, be honest, own it, you know, become one with it. Really get down in with that fear and see just where it's coming from. And then when it comes up, stop it. And just don't go there. Instead, do something positive. And if you do that and you really put a focus on it, in 3 months, that fear will probably be gone or very low. In 6 months, it most certainly, you know, will not be bothering you anymore. Then you start with the next fear, all right? You got one. You probably have 20 or 30. You have a lot of them. Start on the next one. Eventually, you get rid of the whole bunch, and you will become love. You will turn into a loving, caring people, a caring person that is interested in other. What can I do to help? How can I serve? How can I help the situation? And you don't have a lot of needs and wants and desires the way things have to be. They just go away. So it's not like you have to learn to act good and stuff these needs and desires down in your subconscious someplace. You have to learn how to be good and not have those needs and desires at all. They're just not part of you. So that's the difference. All real growth happens at the being level, not at the intellectual level. So this is not about how you act. It's about how you are.
And on the same idea, would you say that synchronicity could be a tool to get more information / meanings?
Absolutely. The system wants you to succeed. And if it can just dump the right thing at the right time in front of your feet or idea in your mind or in your intuition, it will do that. If you're ready and open and can use it, you'll get all the help that you need. And that's what we call synchronicity. It's when something just happens at the right time. It's just what we need. We walk into a library and we're full of angst about something, and it's almost like some book, you know, almost jumps off the shelf into your hand. You know, it's sticking out a little further than the rest. It's got a bright red cover that catches your eye, whatever it is. And you go up and you get it, and it's something you can use. Or you just run into somebody and you're down and out and have been out of work for a month, and because you did something nice or thinking positive thoughts, you run into somebody who just happens to know somebody who has a job looking for somebody just like you. This is synchronicity. It works that way. The more you cooperate with it, the more your life is like that. Eventually, when you become love, when you get rid of all your fear and ego, every day is like that. Everything that would, you know, that would be good for you, everything that brings you joy, it just falls in front of you every day. You don't control anything, yet life gets to be even better than anything you could imagine even if you were the dictator of everything and can control everything. It just works for you. Synchronicity is a daily thing. Talk to people who are very right-brained, and they live in a world of synchronicity daily. We left-brainers, it just happens every once in a while, and we look at that and say, wow, what a circumstance. That just happened at just the right time. And then if that does that 3 or 4 times in a row, maybe, we begin to open our minds a little bit. Maybe something else is going on.
Yeah.
Somebody's trying to tell me something or give me a break or slap me to get my attention.
This is still a bit more intellectual.
Synchronicity can also be a slap.
But I just kind of want to clarify something here. Language can be difficult. When you talk about the idea earlier, you know, all these ideas of a sort of, however we want to say this, probability functions, right? It's a sort of quantum reality, whatever phrasing you want to use. But everything is a certain probability. Makes me think of, I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Anton Wilson's maybe logic. It's a very similar idea that, okay, everything's going to be a certain statistical possibility, and you can never say this is this or isn't this. You can just say it seems this way to me, or it seems likely that it is such and such, but there you sort of remove any of the, you know, quote unquote facts, you know, what exactly. Everything's probable, nothing is true or untrue. And it's a sort of really interesting idea. What I guess I would like to clarify is when you talk about this idea of